Bonjour, bienvenue. Hell yes, this is the 50th Tortoise Shack Sunday special. Can't believe we've done 50 of these, Tony. Can't believe it.
Shows you how we've been living in lockdown, and we've taken a few little knocks. Can I be really bold and just say, now knowing this, and I just want to say and acknowledge at the outset that we lost our friend Don Foster this week. And while we're trying to, you know, keep it light and have these conversations, we are obviously all missing her, and it's important that we mark that as well. She was a brilliant contributor all across the Tortoise Shack, but she was always great on the Sunday shows, and she looked forward to those. So, you know, just wanted to mark that.
Thanks for that, Tony. Thank you. And it is our golden anniversary on the show, and we've decided to do things that are close to our hearts this week. And what's always close to our heart is safer from harm. So, Tony, I'm going to kick it over to you, and you can introduce everybody.
Well, we are joined, obviously, by our friend from police, Vicky Conway, and by CEO of Anna Liffey, Tony Duffin. And I see Dr. Garrett McGovern is here as well. And we will be joined shortly by Patrick Costello of the Greens. But we will go first to Mr. Duffin himself, if we don't mind, Tony. Can we go into, first of all, what happened this week in terms of the High Court moving to change the planning permission for what we've been waiting for a long time in Merchants Quay as a safe injection site?
Yeah, okay, thanks, and good afternoon, everybody. And it is lovely to be back with you guys, and it is 3 years since I was with you. But this week, 15th of July, which was Thursday, there was a judicial review, an outcome from a judicial review, I suppose, which found that, there was a bit of confusion, actually. The narrative in the media and on the radio was that it was overturned and that was the end of it. That was very early on Thursday morning and right through the day. That doesn't appear to be the case, actually. The courts have a process whereby they are accepting submissions to, I think it was put aside, and they're accepting submissions in October. I think it was Tricia Sheehy Skeffington, and in a tweet she did a really good thread. If anyone's interested, have a look on that online. One of the tweets was, the court did say that the supervised injection center should not be given permission to Merchants Quay. Did not say that the supervised injection center should not be given permission Merchants Quay. Its main point is that if strongly held opposition was to be rejected, a reasonable explanation must be given. So the point being is that there's other options yet to be considered, and that's good to hear. That's good to hear in the sense that Merchants Quay, who are the preferred provider for the supervised injection facility, and they put out a tweet as well, saying they were committed to supervise injecting, and the process is ongoing. So it's legal systems and structures going through the motions, but it is frustrating. The legislation was signed into being in 2017, May of 2017. So the Misuse of Drugs Supervised Injection Facilities Act was signed in then by our president, Michael D. Higgins. So it's taking a long time. But that said, I guess these things do take a bit of time. You can look at what happened in Portugal with regards to their legislation. They had it in place for about 20 years before they finally got a mobile service up and running. But they do. And now they also have a fixed site up and running now. We should come back to the idea of mobiles units in a moment, perhaps. You can also look at Sydney and their supervised injection facility. They had I think it was a Catholic church, which was willing to locally to deliver the service. They were told that they couldn't then do that. And it moved over to another church who then went on to deliver the service. But that took a couple of years. That added time. So this kind of
Tony,
Can
I just say that it's worth reminding people that this is about safer from harm.
Yeah.
this is about saving lives. That's why injection facilities are so important. It's to cut down the death rate from drugs. That's the ultimate purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a couple of things that we've looked at over the last number of years. One is decriminalization. Today we're talking about supervised injecting. And the interesting thing about all of this is we're way beyond the discussion around whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. Legislation is introduced. The government said it's going to happen. This is just a matter of getting this implemented now. And it is frustrating because it will save lives and it will get people through to treatment and rehabilitation faster than otherwise. It does reduce street-based injecting in the area where it is based. And, you know, unfortunately for the area around Merchants Quay, they do have, and this is why they were identified, I'm sure, they do have a street-based injecting problem, public injecting, and that will be reduced. And also it just, you know, you don't introduce these services to make things worse. You introduce them to make things better and improve the amenity of the area, you know. And yeah, the judicial review was brought by the local school, and their argument, broadly speaking, was that they were concerned for the children, they were concerned for them being exposed to injecting in the streets and such. That's already going on, and this is designed to reduce that.
I'm going to be very blunt about it. Like what we saw, some of the things we saw at the Temple Bar Company tweeting the most inappropriate tweet I thought imaginable. Patrick Costlow is joined us from the Green Party, and he is the TD for that area. And Patrick, I know you've written about this in a personal capacity. You've spoken about this as well. You're in government, mate. Tell me how we get this done, Patrick. Tell me what we're doing.
You're going to keep holding that one over me, aren't you? But anyway, I think as Tony says, we're long past the conversation of whether this is a good idea or not. But I think that there's a lot of people who still don't think this is a good idea. Like when Catherine Byrne was Minister for Drug Strategy, she was pushing hard to try and make this happen. But there still seemed to be quiet, unspoken, behind-the-scenes resistance. And I don't know if that's the guards, I don't know, or not. I honestly don't know. It's the same with the Department of Justice. I don't know if there's still a reluctance there or not. One of the issues from local residents, and I think myself and Michael Pidgeon, Councillor Michael Pidgeon, put out a press release there pointing out that this decision will cost lives. I think we're the only local representatives willing to actually support this project. And I've got, let's just say interesting feedback from local residents who disagree with me. But I think one of the main concerns is that this will act as a magnet and pull people into the area, pull drug users and drug dealers into the area. Now, look, we can talk, as Tony said, there's already a street-based injecting problem in the area. But I think if the concern is that this will be a mecca that pulls people in, then let's go big. Let's ensure that there is this kind of facility not in just one places, but lots of places. The whole point was this is supposed to be a pilot and let's prove it. We've introduced the legislation. Let's do our pilot and let's roll it out from there and all the learnings from there, which is the normal slow way Irish civil service works. So for me, I think the question is not how do we make this one site work, but how do we make this as an idea work? And for me, it's go big or go home. Like, let's counteract the fear that this will be a magnet in one neighborhood by providing it in lots of neighborhoods. But it's the same also with the needle exchange that's already there in Merchants Quay. You know, there are people who will travel up to Dublin once a week, once a month to stock up in the needle exchange there because there aren't the facilities where they are. So, if we want to have less people drawn to the area, we need to provide these facilities everywhere they're needed. So I think the thing is, as I say, go big or go home. So while I may be in a party that supports government, unfortunately, I don't have a ministerial seal. So I'll be having these questions with my colleagues and those in other parties who actually do have that ministerial seal. I know we in the Greens have always talked about drugs being a social issue and a health issue, not a criminal justice issue. I think services like this are really important for realigning it as a social issue, as a health issue.
Vicky, you do a lot of work with people in policing situations. Is drug use a big common factor across the board?
Well, like what I was going to say there is, like, I think it's interesting to have people saying they're maybe concerned because it might draw people in. I really wonder about whether that's a narrative that you can put on your concern, and whether the actual concern is just, are we condoning this? Are we saying we're okay with this if we're supporting it? And I really think, like, Patrick mentioned the guards in passing, but I actually think it's a really big factor in this. And I suspect, you know, the commissioner of the guards have a huge hand in all of these policies. And, you know, to turn around to a situation where the guards, on the one hand, like, so much of their day-to-day work is actually criminalising drug use. I mean, that's so much of what they do. So many of the people that they engage with, so much. We look at this in the courts and the prisons, how many people that are ending up there and are being criminalised are engaged in drug use. And somebody mentioned cognitive dissonance in the comments. For the guards, there's real cognitive dissonance in saying, on the one hand, we do all of this work every day, and then we're going to facilitate a safe site. And I'm not agreeing with that position. I think this is, in some ways, very challenging for police culture to take these steps. But they shouldn't be allowed to have the control that I suspect that they have, or the influence that they have in relation to this. And it's that real, you know, it's that question of, like, I think it's very linked to criminalisation, full stop, and all of those arguments and debates.
There was, I believe it was in the last couple of weeks, the commissioner came out and said that those who are advocating for free, safe, legal, and also for, sorry, those who are advocating for safe harm, for decriminalising the model, that they would have to think very carefully about it. And I thought that was an odd comment for the Garda Commissioner to come out with. I thought that was more a political comment rather than a policing comment.
Yeah, and I think they're just, their work and their space is criminalising this stuff. And that's so much of their authority and their power stems from cracking down on people. So I think there's something very fundamentally being challenged for the guards in these developments. And I think that's a really good thing, and it has to happen. But yeah, you really, like, I think we often don't know a whole lot about the relationship between the commissioner and government and how that relationship influences policy. But, you know, you can bet anything that the commissioner is a key part of all of these talks. And that's something we should be kind of scrutinizing a bit more. What influence is he having over these policies? Yeah,
but the whole, so there's policing, there's the local population, there's some great points by Zoe in the comments around, you know, the parents, part of the judicial review, funding it, all of these things that are making things more difficult. But I suppose some of the things that this boils down to, Tony, you know this, we've the studies, places where it works, places where it's done, mm-hmm. It saves lives. That's where this doesn't make sense, where people are, you're actually turning around to people and saying, what you're actually campaigning for will hurt people. And how did we lose that argument?
How did we lose that argument?
Yeah.
I don't think we did. I think it's an interesting, drug policy is so frustrating. So we start talking about supervised injecting and then we get on to legalization or whatever. So just to come back on this idea of legalization, it gets conflated with decrim. Decrim is not legalization. Lots of people are really pro legalization, and lots of people are really pro prohibition. And you know, when you look at it all, you just get into your camps and you just fight and you don't move forward. And the low hanging fruit, and indeed the evidence is good for decrim, is the middle ground where drugs remain illegal, that satisfies the prohibitionists, and the response is a health issue that satisfies some of the people on the legalization side, in the sense that you won't get a criminal record, you'll get help and support. And you know, we are moving. We have a national drug strategy. It talks about a health-led approach, and we are moving towards that. It is taking some time, and I suppose that is part of the problem in Ireland. Is we do actually have a really good national drug strategy. The implementation thereof is taking considerable time. No supervised injection facilities yet. We haven't got a health-led approach yet. You know, but we are. You know, if you read it and you know what's going on in the background, you know that people are moving towards it, but my God, is it taking time. And in the meantime, Tony, your point, people are getting arrested, people are dying, stigma kills people, you know, so there's all that sort of thing going on. And come back to Vicky's point, you know, about you know, talking there about the commissioner and such. You know, in Ireland, the reality on the ground is we have a law enforcement and a public health approach to drug use. We do. And we should be proud of that. We do a lot. Analyfi and other agencies, NGOs and the HSE and the guards and the city council all work together, but we haven't gone far enough. But we are, sorry, when I say city council, obviously I'm talking about, I'm thinking Dublin, but and wider afield, you know, there's work down in Cork, for example. They wanted to deliver a supervised injection facility very, very early on. And they had the guards on side and the city council on side and the local drugs task force. They had it all in, but they were told they had to wait until the pilot in Dublin was evaluated before they could get going. Limerick has a public injecting problem, and other areas, mostly urban, but other areas. So we could go back to Patrick's point. We need to go bigger. Is that how you described it, Patrick? Yeah, go big.
You said go big or go home. But
go big or go home. That sounds good to me.
But back, actually, we'll come to you, Patrick, on it, because again, the political will. When you was asked in the comments who was the minister with responsibility, and you pointed out it is Frank Fien. And I remember when he came, and Tony, you'd remember this as well. It was a change of government. They're knocking it all together. And his first statement, he used the phrase war on drugs. Actually, appeared in the actual couple of paragraphs that he issued. And I remember thinking, oh God, we're going back again. And now I'm not saying that's. It was almost, let's try the thing that we've tried that hasn't worked again. And you have to, I'm not saying that that's where his position is. He's not here to talk, but Patrick, you again, the politics of this, there's small C conservatives, and then there's people who are trying to push this forward. You are there. You have to be advocating for this. I mean, have you spoken to Frank Fien about this?
No, I'll be honest, I haven't spoken to him yet. I know in previous statements he talked before about his concern about sort of the criminality of it and the links between, you know, the average Friday night for a lot of people, the average Saturday night, and the criminal gangs that funds. But, you know, the solution to that is the decriminalization, or even the legalization more accurately. Like, I think there's a real challenge here, because I just want to go back to something Vicky said there about that, you know, there's a perception that harm reduction is condoning drug use. And when we were speaking about this on Dublin City Council a couple of years back, when the planning approval was first announced, there were councillors on there who were apoplectic and who were very against this for, you know, the reason that this was condoning drug use. But I think, you know, that it's easy to look at harm reduction if you look at it in isolation and say that it is either condoning drug use or enabling drug use, or it's about containment of the user, containment of the problems away from nice middle class areas. And I think that's easy to do if you look at harm reduction in isolation. And the political thing is not about harm reduction in isolation, but looking about drug strategy in the broad sense, prevention. Going back to the Rabbit report, that is still very valid. You know, proper drug treatment. We barely have any decent drug treatment. Well, I shouldn't say decent, but we barely have any drug treatment services in this country. The ones that are there are very decent DAC ads. But, you know, we barely have any. And there's a real struggle there to provide the sort of emergency treatment that's needed and responsive treatment, I should say. So the political thing is I think, to overcome the concerns about harm reduction is to look at this in a broader lens and to fit in all those other things. Also, to look at this as a much wider thing. We just can't be focused on one pilot. We really do need to look more. And I think there is an appetite to move.
Can I bring in?
There is an appetite in the other parties to move beyond the criminality aspect of it, because they know themselves it isn't working. And they know themselves that you do need a more health and social based approach. Whether that joins up with the actual policy decisions that are needed is a whole other conversation.
Like, I just think it's always put in the comment about how few rehab beds there are, like 140 for 18,000 opioid users. But, you know, we'll happily create more and more prison spaces. Like, that doesn't seem to be an issue at all. And I remember, like, just a conversation I was having earlier this year that really struck me with somebody saying, like, you know, if you really think about this as addiction, like, in what world would we in Ireland arrest somebody for drinking? But it could be the same thing, right? Because it's still an addiction. And it's, but we would never think about doing that. We would never think about responding that way. And the criminal justice system is one of the few places where we're still looking at drugs as a moral wrong, like that you've literally committed a crime. You've done something so wrong, that we're going to use the powers of the state against you. And it's baffling.
But you equally, you had, again, back when the first planning permission came out, you had like Temple Bar and pubs in Temple Bar complaining about the risk of antisocial behavior. And like, as we all know, Temple Bar is a horrible place because of the antisocial behavior fueled by alcohol. So there is this, you know, as Danny said, and with Nell and I, why trust one drug and not another?
Garrett, you've just said there on the comments that more detox bed is not the answer to the complex issue of street injecting. What can we do in the interim?
I think in the interim, I think we have to realize that this legal battle is going to rock on. So I don't see, for instance, a sort of a stationary site in the next 18 months. It's not going to happen. I think what we have to do now is we have to go down the route of mobile units. We could get them probably up and running within a few months. They largely, you know, solve that problem of NIMBY to a large extent, I feel. Cheaper to run. And I think we need to get that operational ASAP. I think that I think it's pie in the sky to think we're going to get an injecting center in Dublin City probably in the next 2 years. I'd love to be proved wrong, but I don't see it.
Yeah, I mean, look, Garrett's right. I mean, when you look at other jurisdictions and what they've done in the, you know, you know, there's these moral discussions and debates that have gone on surrounding the supervised injecting, and then there's the bureaucracy of the municipal structures at local levels, planning permission, all this sort of thing. What they've done elsewhere is they've introduced mobile units. And the next thing that will be said is that the legislation refers to premises. But there is ways around that, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. You know, the one thing I would say about the last 16 months or whatever, you know, under COVID and responding to that, you know, we've proven that we can respond quickly. So to give you an example, we went from a 12 to 13 week wait to get people onto methadone to 2 to 3 days. And that was done almost overnight by the HSC. Brilliant. Okay. We had before that, for various clinical reasons, we weren't allowed to get people onto benzodiazepine stabilization scripts. Once COVID kicked in, we were. Okay, we've been asking for that for some time, and we were. So, you know, there is, you know, decisions were being made last, you know, early last year, March, April, May, June, that were being made that would have taken months and years to make. They were being made in practically minutes, hours and days, you know, like really, it was, you really can choose to do what you want to do, you know? So that's the one point. And I think, you know, you could award a license to a premises, and you could stipulate that the mobile unit is attached to that premises, and then you can do it. And then, sorry, in my understanding, okay? So that would be good. That would be great.
I think that's like, okay, so here's one thing that we should be pushing for immediately, mobile units doing these things. I think that's great. Zoe's made another great contribution to a wider plan of how things can be tackled. We've seen how these things can actually do. But I want to go back to what Cleanan Kialig said to us during when COVID kicked off, and we were covering it in depth here. I remember her saying, because she works with the inclusion team in James's, and Tony, you know a lot of those.
Yeah.
They're the people that you help and
colleagues
support.
And they're your
crew as well. But the funniest things that Cleanan was telling us was how it changed the lives of some of the users, the people who were getting support services that did change for them overnight. One of them referred to getting stable accommodation as, "Yo man, it's like MTV Cribs," right? And it just shows that, as you said, if there is ability to act in real time, you can change outcomes and improve people's lives and give them that stability. Again, back to Patrick on this.
Patrick.
We always appreciate that Patrick always steps up and takes and answers the questions anyway. But Patrick, within the actual the politics of this, though, what is the I don't want to hate using that. Someone is saying is the political will is our main enemy. Yeah, it probably is. But do you think that the public are ahead of the politics again in this situation? Like, because we've seen it with other changes in Irish society in the last two referendums, where the Irish society was well ahead of where the politics are. Or do we actually have to have a bigger conversation that maybe there's a need for an equivalent sort of citizens assembly that talks about these things properly?
For some issues, I think a citizens assembly just slows things down. And, you know, where there is broad agreement or where there is strong arguments from international perspectives, where there is, you know, peer-reviewed research showing that certain interventions save lives, then we shouldn't need a citizens' assembly. Mm-hmm. Now, there was previously a high-level group, an expert group, looking at the issue of drugs and decriminalisation and our approach to drugs. So again, I think a citizens' assembly would just be repeating that kind of work. I think there's a couple of elements here. I think, you know, as Tony says, there are two camps. There are those who are legalise everything and those who are in favour of prohibition. And never the twain shall meet in some ways. And I think that, you know, if you look at TDs, that's, I think that spectrum is represented in there among TDs. Then you do have the political thing of, you know, someone might, a TD who doesn't want to get ahead of where their vote is. So a more conservative party might be worried that their more conservative voters, you know, don't want to get ahead of them. Whereas, as you say, in reality, the voters are way ahead of them already, as we have seen in the last two referendums. So I think there's kind of both aspects at play. But again, I go back to the fact that, look, this is proven science. We shouldn't need, you know, a high level review followed by a scoping exercise to guide the pilot, followed by a review of the pilot, followed by a further scoping exercise, followed by a preparation of a tender document, followed by a review of the tender, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we know this works. We have people eager to take up these services. We have several options in terms of the mobile units, in terms of the premises. And we know that we need to go big so that we don't create problems of it being a magnet. So let's just get out there and do this. But as I say, I think the big political thing is those two other things. Harm reduction is really important, but we do need treatment. We do need prevention. As Garrett said in the comments, treatment and prevention aren't going to fix street-based injecting instantly, but you do need all three. You do need all three for a proper drug strategy.
Yeah. That's a given. I think it's not always understood, but you know, we have a, for want of a better description, a continuum of care, where, you know, where people at one end are using in the streets, injecting down alleyways, and another end, you know, entering into recovery, and that can be stabilization, and that can be abstinence, and ultimately moving away and just living their lives. And having all of that in place, everything from prevention to supply control, whatever, and through to treatment and rehabilitation, is really needs to be understood that we're not talking just about harm reduction. This is the system working together.
And what happens, what can happen, is people will use the lack of treatment or the lack of prevention as supply and demand reduction, you know, as a reason to come down and say harm reduction doesn't work, or a reason to object to harm reduction for all those moral reasons Vicky was saying. So there's a tactical thing to having all three, because it makes harm reduction easier to sell. And harm reduction
also, isn't it, like we say, harm reduction doesn't work. Well, like, what are you expecting it to do? What it says it's going to do is reduce harm. And if it's doing that, then it's achieving its aim. And it's like this point, this, Tony, I can't even believe you suggested a citizen assembly on this. Like people, harm is being caused every day that we wait on this, you know, every delay. Individuals are suffering, their health is suffering, families are suffering. It's, yeah, sorry, that's
thanks,
just
a random point. Thanks for doing that. Thanks. Listen, I'm going to move the conversation on a little. And Patrick, you've had a very busy week this week. I can't remember. Oh, yeah, it was CETA you were at this week. Wasn't that it?
Yeah.
Can you, now that your side of the case is over, can you give us sort of an idea of how it went for you?
Are you allowed commentary?
Well, there's nothing to stop me commenting, but I think that, with any case, it's best not to talk too much about it in the public until everything, all the dust has settled. I should have sent you guys the video link, of course, because there were some journalists tuning in. You guys could have tuned in and spent 4 days of legal arguments.
The court reporters covered it absolutely brilliantly. I think Mary was absolutely.
Oh, and she sat. I think it. she sat through it all, or certainly I could see her logged in for all of it. Like, so, yeah. You know, I am.
I just want to give
an official from the Department of Enterprise and Trade was logged in and watching it all as well.
For listeners' benefits, Patrick is one of two politicians, but one who actually happens to be a member of a party of government who took a case to see if CETA, with the idea of investor dispute mechanisms, an additional court mechanism, is constitutional or not. And that was the gist of this, Patrick, whether that was going to be legal or not. And that's now, we've no judgment as it stands, but the case itself is now complete, yes?
Yeah, so we've made our arguments. The state have made their counter arguments. We try to stand up and say why those arguments are, let's say, wrong. And the judge has retired with a library of submissions and cases and notes and, you know, 4 days worth of transcripts to entertain her for the summer and to do her job. And she'll come back with a judgment as soon as she can. And I think, you know, I think, look, it's going to, I think...
It's an important judgment, Patrick. It will be important either way.
Yeah. No, and like this is the thing, like there's several angles to it. Like, look, for me, the initial thing was looking at this in terms of taking away controversies that would normally be before the Irish courts and a weakening of the Irish courts. But behind it, there's lots of other things, because where the rules coming that this ICS system will look at, where the rules that this court, these new courts will judge things by. And they're coming from this, from the agreement, they're coming from the joint committee, who again are essentially making laws for Ireland outside of the Irish constitutional order, you know. And then the state were arguing that this was about an obligation, this was an obligation of our membership of the European Union. And we've already said in our constitution, like, look, if the European Union, if we have to do something because of being in the European Union, you can't argue it's unconstitutional, because we've already agreed to be in the European Union. So there was all sorts of EU law arguments in relation to, was this a shared competence or a mixed competence? Does a mixed competence ever become a shared competence? Does a shared competence ever become a sole competence? So there's a lot of technical EU stuff going on as well there. And you never know, maybe it needs a trip to Luxembourg to unravel those bits.
You're looking very fresh for a fella that spent 4 days in court.
I'm conscious of time, guys.
There's lots and lots of coffee, Martin. Lots and lots of coffee.
It's been a very busy week. I want to actually point out yesterday, Martin, that we got mentioned in a story relating to the housing minister and comments made. We didn't get credited, but he made the comments on the podcast.
We had the housing minister on, and just for other Fianna Fáil politicians, look, we're not that scary. It's okay. So he came on with us and we had this conversation, and I asked him about the upward only rent 4% nonsense that's been going on and putting people under extreme pressure. And he told us that it was illegal from the moment he spoke to us. It was illegal.
He said it was illegal from when the president signed it.
But it hadn't been. Isn't that the case?
It hadn't been commenced, and it's still not commenced. In fact, actually, it's going to go up till the 26th of July, which is giving a lot of landlords, unfortunately, time to rush out there and send people saying, oh, your rent's going up by 4% or 8% in many cases, because they're getting they're saying the 2 years, because there was a rent freeze in 2020 due to COVID. So some are looking for 8%. It's outrageous, because the most they should be allowed to get is 1.73%, in line with what this new rule is, in line with basically the old basket of goods, as we used to call in basic economics, your old inflation index. So it's really not a great thing to see this and give the landlords a lead in where they have a time to get these things done. So it's the same with so many things in Ireland. When a stroke of a pen could have fixed it, a commencement date could have been the commencement date, but unfortunately we've left it and given another window, and there are people getting demands and threshold, getting hundreds of phone calls. It is a cruel thing. I do also, Tony, Mr. Duffin, you guys need to, can you tell our listeners where they can find you guys and what supports you need as well, if that's okay?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you can visit safefromharm.ie. We've got a website up there in terms of the work around decriminalisation, and there's work there around the supervised injecting, and also aldp.ie. But just want to say, Patrick Costello is probably one of the best informed people, politicians, to have on this show today. He and I, it was 2002, Patrick. We worked together. I set up a street drinkers project in Dublin, and Patrick, very young, fresh faced, Patrick Costello, joined the team and was working there at the front line, saving people's lives. So he's really very well informed on all of this.
Before I joined Anger Street, it was at the time, I had actually been working in Merchants Quay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very much.
There you go. So he's well informed. So, yeah, fair play, Patrick. Good to see you fighting the good fight.
And we must say, Tony Duffin, anytime we speak to you on this, you are the most positive person I have ever come across.
You can't do this job and be negative, that's for sure.
There's nobody as positive I have come across. If we could bottle it, we could sell it. We certainly could.
There's a lot going on out on the streets in Dublin still. There's a lot of heartache, and during COVID, the team were on the ground here, as with many other, and look, I have to say, just take the opportunity. A lot of NGOs worked very, very hard during COVID to protect people who are homeless. Our particular job around COVID was working closely with the HSE and other NGOs to get people to isolation and such. Also working with people around their addiction. A lot of people's lives were saved. Just to give you the listeners an idea, only 4% of the homeless population contracted COVID, okay? And only 4 people passed away. Sadly, they passed away, but the projection was for much, much worse. So I know you like me to talk about negative things, but there was a lot of great work that went on and a lot of success. Now, we're looking back, we're still not out of it, and there's a lot of work to do, but there was great leadership from the HSE and some awesome work from all the NGOs, so we can be really proud. And not just in Dublin, but just around the country, of course. Yeah, brilliant.
So Tony and I, we're getting to that part where we're just going to go us only and have that conversation, like our OnlyFans conversation that we have once we stop the recording. But before we get there, and I'm going to say this, I'm going to be straight up. This is the tortoise shack. We need your money. So if you want to see this project, if you want to see this project grow, if you want to see this project continue to do the work that it does, you have to stick your hand in your pocket and support us at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And I make no apologies for saying that.
Well, Martin, already have a mic. What more do you need?
Yeah.
you think the beauty in this face doesn't cost? It costs. Botox. Yeah. Botox is costing me and Leo a fortune. You know.
Filters.
So before we wrap, we have a busy week ahead of us, and we're looking forward to talking to all sorts of people on all sorts of subjects. I'll be doing a bit on bogus self-employment. I know we'll be doing a bit on other stuff as well, and police will have more work.
Ivana Bacic should be joining us for her how she's got on in her first couple of weeks as a TD as well, so that should be interesting.
Well, she got them 3% in the polls today, up 3%.
They're calling it the Bacic bounce still. So, but we started a conversation with her the last day around sex work, and we didn't get to complete that as well. So we'll have to have that conversation as well. So it's fair play to her for coming back. She said she would. So we'll have that conversation. On a Sunday show schedule, guys, we're going to take off. So 50 weeks, 50 Sundays in a row, we're going to actually take you. You'll still get podcasts. If you missed during the week, Art, the podcast on Lebanon was fantastic. Hannah McCarthy, Irish Beirut-based journalist, joined us, and the situation there is absolutely dire, with like 1 hour of electricity in many locations, the economy completely reliant on people sending money home on remittances. If you don't have dollars, you don't have anything. Food poisoning kicking off because they can't refrigerate anything, and everybody is getting food poisoning. So please, if you want to go back through the back catalog, I would say listen to that as well, because for me now it's a really important story. And I'd say a personal link there, one of my in-laws is out there as a peacekeeper at the moment, so obviously I'm in that, but that's the gist of it. And yes, Oisin, we are allowed to take a little bit of a break. We will wrap it there, but we'll stay on if anybody has any questions, or just put your hands up. I'd be delighted to chat for a little while longer, because there's been fantastic detail in the comments. But if you want to, we can turn on the mics and have a conversation. Tony Duffin, Patrick Costlow, Gareth McGovern, thank you for joining us. We know that was it was something this week that was a big story for us. Maybe it didn't make as many headlines as we wanted, but we thought what you guys do, what you advocate in Analifi for, is harm reduction, and it will save lives. So please support the lads if you can. ALDP.ie. There is a donate button. There's a /donate. I know we're always asking for money, but these things really make a difference. Any questions? Throw up your hands, and we'll just let everybody get out and enjoy the sunshine.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.